Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we are proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click on the donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
I'm in chapter 13, verse 9, where it says, "Do not be led away by diverse and strange teachings. For it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, which have not benefited those devoted to them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat." Well, in my opinion, these are some of the most important words in the entire epistle, because they reveal the main conflict that the epistle has been attempting to resolve. I believe the whole epistle to the Hebrews, this word of exhortation, was written to counter these diverse and strange teachings, of which he's referencing here, which were leading brothers and sisters away from allegiance to Yeshua of Nazareth, from the sect of the Nazarenes. And if you'll allow me to speculate, I think I can reconstruct the diverse and strange teachings just based on what we're reading here and what we've studied so far in the book of Hebrews. I think I can reconstruct what these diverse and strange teachings were. It appears to me, and I'm speculating, I'll admit that, it appears to me that a recent teaching among the Jewish believers had been circulating regarding participation in the sacrificial services, regarding their participation in the peace offerings and the sin offerings of the temple, which are the only two types of sacrifices that are eaten. So the teachings to which he refers probably involve some mystical interpretation of these sacrificial services, which implied some critical spiritual benefit from them. For example, unless the priests actually eat the meat of the sin offering on your behalf, you don't find atonement, or your sins aren't forgiven, or unless you actually eat from the meat of the Passover sacrifice at Pesach, you have no share in the master's table. So I don't know what it was. I can't tell you what exactly it was, but there was some critical spiritual benefit implied. Unless you actually eat of the peace offerings, you bring a peace offering, you don't have you're missing this spiritual fellowship. Something, I don't know. Something along these lines, but he refers to the meat of the sacrificial animals when he says, it's good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, which have not benefited those devoted to them. So, how do I know? Thanks. I anticipate my every need. How do you know that it's specifically sacrificial foods which the writer has in view? Because he says, we have an altar from which those who serve in the tent have no right to eat. So this implies that we're talking about those who serve in the tent. What is the altar that they have a right to eat? Well, that's the sacrifices. That's the sacrifice. Those who serve in the tent means the priesthood, which has been a major theme of the entire epistle so far. The sons of Aaron, who had the obligation, as I was mentioning to the children, you know, the spiritual worship, the obligation to eat the priestly portions of the various sacrifices. For them, I mean, I like the idea. Eating the sacrifices was a mitzvah. I mean, just like, it didn't matter. It's like, oh no, I'm not hungry. Too bad. The Torah required them to eat the priestly portions. You remember the story in Leviticus 11. Moses is very angry. Finds out the sin offering was burned up. He says, hey, that was the time you were supposed to eat that kind because his blood wasn't brought inside the holy place. Aaron's like, yeah. Well, it was full. Yeah. So it's an obligation. It's an obligation as much as a part, as much as an obligation as much as anything in the sacrificial services. The priests had a share in the sacrifices that went on the altar, and they're obligated to eat it. So when the writer of the book of Hebrews says, those who serve the tent, he's referring to this, to the Aaronic priesthood, and particularly, you know who he has in mind. We know from the historical context he has in mind the high priest, the high priesthood, the Sadducean elite, the Sadducees who dominated the high priest, the enemies of the believers who were forcing the believers out of the temple. The high priesthood was barring the believers from participating in the sacrificial services. And that barred them from Passover, from the peace offerings, from a sin offering. And under these circumstances, that's where diverse and strange teachings began to circulate, which inferred that without access to those rites, the believers were left in some sort of spiritually deficient state. Yeah, maybe you don't know what I mean. You're going, I'm not tracking with you. I'll give you an example. Let me switch contexts here. Moving out of the first century into the Middle Ages or any time thereafter. This whole idea is very similar to the Christian idea of sacrament, particularly the Eucharist. According to the Christian interpretation of the concept of sacrament, certain rituals, you know, the idea of sacrament is that certain rituals impart grace upon the Christian, right? For example, in the Roman confession, the Orthodox confession, you serve Mass every day. Every day, you know, maybe twice a day. Maybe three times a day. I don't know how many times a day. Every day. And the idea is that you serve the Mass, you take the Eucharist, you take the host every day, and participation in these this ritual, in the ceremonial foods, it's actually food, it's actually you ingest it, just like the sacrifices, you see. You actually ingest it, and it's the bread and the cup, you know, bread and the cup of the Master. And that by doing this, by participating in this ritual, maintains your spiritual status within the church, and before God, maintains your salvation, so to speak. So you don't want to go too long without. You know, it's like an oil change. You know, maybe a week. Maybe a week is like as long as you really want to push it. Because, like, if we get too far out from the last time you took confession, anyway, it depends on your confession. There's different interpretations along this. But once a week, at least, is what I'm saying. Don't. And, you know, so then there's the Protestants who just, like, are so much smarter than that. And they're like, oh. The Protestants, and here's how the Protestants show that they reject that sacramental interpretation. We do the Lord's Supper only once a month. You know, that'll show Johnny Catholic. You know, it's like, whatever. According to this idea, actually ingesting the host, eating the ceremonial food imparts grace to you, right? And so here's another interesting parallel to the situation that we read about in the book of Hebrews, as I'm reconstructing the book of Hebrews for you. The high church can then punish you and actually cut you off from grace, which means to be cut off from God, by refusing to serve you the Eucharist. Now, I know, if you're Protestant, you're thinking, well, I'll just go get my own Eucharist. How much can those little wafers cost? But it doesn't work like that. That's called being excommunicated. So they can cut you off from God by refusing to serve you the wafer. So you see, I'm just using this as an example to try to. Now I'll take you back to the first century, context. You see something very similar going on. According to my theory, the believers had been excommunicated, so to speak, from access to the temple by this sect, this powerful, rich, hedonistic sect of priests that had seized power and held power for more than a generation now in the temple. And they had these Sadducees, and they banned the believers, they excommunicated them, and now strange and diverse teachings were circulating that elevated the sacrificial services to sacramental status. And these teachings were pressuring the believers to renounce Yeshua, to renounce their faith in the Messiah so that they could regain admission to the temple and then participate again in the sacrificial services and regain their spiritual status before Hashem. That's how I read it. That's what I think is going on here. And most of my approach and argument for the last year as we've studied this way, our way through the epistles, just based on these couple verses here at the end where he finally bottom lines us. He says, okay, don't let anyone mislead you with strange and diverse teachings. So he says, don't be led away by strange and diverse teachings, strange teachings which are assigning some sort of sacramental value to the sacrifices, for it's good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods. It's God's grace, it's God's favor. And what does that mean? It's his favor that he found, favor that Yeshua, his son, has found in his eyes rather than ceremonial food. So according to one theory, you can attain God's favor by participation in a ritual, in a ceremonial food. Wouldn't that be nice? Sacrificial service in the temple, in the days of the temple. You just go up and you eat this, eat that, and you're good. Or, you know, you just go to church, you know, going back to the church context, just go eat this, eat that, you're good. That'd be great. It's like a magic pill. You know, it's just what we need. It's like the weight loss drug. Yeah, salvation drug. According to the writer of the book of Hebrews, however, spoil sport, rituals and ceremonial foods do not benefit you at all. Instead, grace is imparted to you through your allegiance to Yeshua of Nazareth, in whom God has found favor. But there is no magic food that will make God love you or bless you. All right, so here, first of all, I'm going to point out, he is not criticizing the concept of participating in ceremonies. He's not criticizing, you know, the Passover or the Lord's Supper or whatever, or the participation in the, you know, having the peace offerings and this sort of thing. And if the opportunity was there, he certainly would be encouraging the believers to participate as they always had, but he would caution them against strange and diverse teachings which might lead them away from the true source of grace and favor, which is allegiance to Yeshua of Nazareth. He says, for it's good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, by chen, not by foods, such as the sin offerings eaten by the priesthood or the peace offerings, which are eaten by the worshipers. Because, he says, those sacrificial portions, which are being eaten every day, have not benefited those devoted to them. It's a very simple argument. Look, if these things are really helpful to your spiritual status, the priests who have been eating the sacrifices daily for more than 500 years, you know, should be, it hasn't benefited them. Look, it's Caiaphas. We're talking about Hanan ben Hanan, or Hanina ben Nedbius. Hanina ben Nedbius. I can never say his last name. It's Greicized. Nedbius. How's that? It doesn't matter. Wicked Sadducees, godless men. It's clearly not helping them to eat sacrifices every day. He says, however, we have an altar from which those who serve at the tent have no right to eat. All right, what is that altar? And, you know, now that I think about it, I suppose this is the very verse from which the early Christians derived the idea that the Lord's Supper is a sacrifice and a sacrament. It's probably at least one of the key verses behind the idea. You know, in the Syriac Church, Eastern Orthodox, and I mean the Syriac-speaking Orthodox Church, the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, is called the Korban, the sacrifice. It's the Hebrew word for sacrifice. And, you know, you need a priesthood for that. If you're going to have a sacrifice, you're sacrificing, you know, sacrifice Christ. You bring the sacrifice of Christ. You need a priesthood for that. And that's why we have a priesthood in the high church. The high church has a priesthood. They function as the Aaronic priesthood. And the Eucharist is the replacement of the sacrificial services. It's based on this idea. We have an altar. We have an altar at which the Jews have no right to eat. So according to the Christian interpretation, the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying, don't worry about the sacrifices in the temple, because we have the Eucharist now. The Jews don't have any right to eat of the Eucharist, right? I don't think that's what's going on here. I don't think that's the correct reading. In fact, I will guarantee you that's not the correct reading. when he says, we have an altar from which those who serve at the tent have no right to eat, he's not referring to any earthly sacrament or substitute for the sacrifices or an altar at the front of a church, which would be completely anachronistic. He's not referring to the Eucharist. Think about it. I mean, come on, we just spent a year learning the book of Hebrews. What have we learned about the temple? The temple below reflects the temple above. The Jerusalem below reflects the Jerusalem above. The temple on earth is a reflection of the heavenly temple, the true temple, the one not made with hands. That means that the altar below is a reflection of a true altar above, the heavenly altar over which the high priest in the order of Melchizedek presides. That is the altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat, the wicked Sadducees. And this, I believe, sums up the whole subject of the book of Hebrews, I think. You know, don't abandon the Messiah for the sake of admission to the temple in Jerusalem and the earthly sacrifices, because if you do, you'll be abandoning heavenly Jerusalem, the heavenly temple, the heavenly sacrifice, which is efficacious not just for this world, but for the Messianic era and the world to come. That's the gist of it. And if that's the gist of it, then why didn't you just say that in the first place? It could have saved us a lot of work, don't you think? Could have saved us a lot of... Well, there's a reason. I mean, the length of the epistle... It's the longest epistle in the New Testament, isn't it? Well, no, probably not. I don't know, maybe. It's a long one, 13 chapters. It's a long epistle at any rate. I mean, Romans seems really long to me. But Romans seems way more tedious. But in any case, it's a long epistle. The length of the epistle and the careful, deliberate, rhetorical arguments in the epistle where you're moving forward in a progressive logic, carefully arguing your point, setting this up, setting that up, you know, now we got this, now we got that, moving towards a conclusion, unlike Paul's epistles, which seem to be going, I'm going this way, no, I'm going this way. Every direction. I mean, this is carefully constructed. The length of it proves how devoted the early Jewish believers were to the temple and to the Levitical worship system. They were undergoing a major, major religious crisis. A shift that left them theologically scrambling to be uprooted from the temple. It was destabilizing. This long epistle is addressing this crisis. And plus, it was deeply offensive. It was deeply offensive to be banned from the temple. I mean, deeply offensive. I mean, it's like being kicked out of your own house by your mom. Yeah, I mean, think about it. It's like, I don't know. Imagine, you know, it's like the holidays. You're home for the holidays. All your siblings, you know, hey, everybody, we're home. Everybody's having a good time. And mom's like, not you. You're out of here. No, I don't want to see you again. No, you don't come back, you know. And you're like, what? Mom, no. But no, out. Okay? And then it's like, and then what's worse is like, it's not just that. It's like every year, it's like all your brothers and sisters like, oh, we had a blast. At that. And you're like, you can't go home. It's like, you're kicked out of your house. That's what it is. It's not, this is the temple. This is your house. This is where you worship. This is where your master spent all of his time and did all of his teaching, and to be kicked out, to lose access to the house of God. It's worse than being kicked out of your own mom's house. This is your God's house. Imagine that. Imagine if God had a house and everybody else got to go visit God and worship God and have a good time with God, but you didn't. It's deeply offensive. You'd probably be pretty unhappy. So the Epistle of the Hebrews attempts to counter that offense by saying, well, yeah, the Sadducees won't let you enter the temple anymore. Oh, yeah. It's a big oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we have an altar at which they can't eat. And it's in heaven. The heavenly altar. The heavenly temple. which is the real temple, not made with hands like yours. That's kind of what's going on. It goes on to say in verse 11, for the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp, which is what we learned this morning. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. National sin offerings, the bulls and the goats brought on behalf of the entire nation, on behalf of the priests or on behalf of the entire nation, are not eaten by anyone. The priesthood offered the choice cuts on the altar, sprinkled their blood inside the holy place, poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar, and then burned the carcass outside of the camp, which in the days of the temple meant outside of the walls of Jerusalem. And they did it over on the Mount of Olives, in fact. We compare our master to one of these national sin offerings by way of metaphor. Just as the sin offering was burned up outside the walls of Jerusalem, our master suffered and died outside the walls of Jerusalem. So the writer of the book of Hebrews makes an equation there between the two, and he says, so let's go outside. Let's go out to him, outside of the camp, which is the city walls, which is Jerusalem, outside of Jerusalem. Bearing his reproach. In other words, let's be willing to suffer this expulsion, this exclusion. We should be willing to be ostracized, to suffer the embarrassment and the shame and the humiliation, because in doing so, we identify with the fellowship of his sufferings, who was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, like one from whom men hide their faces and was despised, and they did not esteem him. And think of that. Think of how many one-time brothers and sisters we've had who did not understand this part of the calling of discipleship. They understood the Torah part. They understood the religion part. They understood the Israel part. But they did not understand the bearing of his reproach part. It's part of the cost of discipleship to be ostracized. And Yeshua assures us, he assures his disciples, you will be hated by all nations because of me. If we're not hated, we must not be doing something right. Well, the good news is, the gospel good news is, that a Messianic Jew is hated, and that a Messianic Gentile is hated. You're in an excellent position to bear Messiah's reproach. You couldn't be in a better place to be reproached. If you're faithful to Yeshua and the demands of discipleship, you will suffer social ostracization. Ostracization, that's it. My spell checker took it. Like a leper forced outside of the gates. You know, that's like the leper is like unclean. Don't touch. You know, like a leper. And if not outright persecution, you know, in some cases, even from the mainstream and especially from the mainstream religious establishments. It's just part of the job of discipleship. Yeshua promised us. He made promises to us. You know, this is one of the promises of God, you can claim. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It's enough for the disciple to be like his teacher and the servant to be like his master. If they call the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they malign those of his household? It's one of the promises to be treated like the master who is despised and rejected. In Messianic Judaism, we can identify with Hebrews 10:13 that says, let's go outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. To find Yeshua, to join him, we have to go outside of the camp of mainstream Judaism. Messianic Jews pay a terrible price and always have for their faith. Devout and God-fearing righteous men and women in the Jewish community consider them accursed, anathema, apostates, idolaters, cut off from the Jewish people. Well, Messianic Gentiles also suffer outside the camp of Israel. You know, the Messianic Gentile adopts a religion and a people who want nothing to do with them. so long as he espouses loyalty to the man from Nazareth, want nothing to do with you. And this places a person in a terribly awkward position, really, where every interaction with the Jewish community, your adopted community, comes with a threat of potential embarrassment and shame. That's bearing the reproach. Not only do we suffer outside the camp of Israel, we suffer outside the camp of the church. The Messianic Jew wants to be a Messianic Jew. You want to be a Messianic Jew, that's fine, as long as you become a Christian, right? And don't be a Jew anymore. That's what the church says. But you want to be a Messianic Jew. You want to be a Jew and raise a Jewish family and live a Jewish life. It's not going to fly. It's not going to fly in the church. So the Messianic Jew suffers outside of the camp of the church. Messianic Judaism is not Christianity, not in the institutional sense. I mean, we're one with our brothers and sisters in every church and denomination. Every church and denomination. That's why I don't discriminate. I pick on everybody. You know, and I love them all. All the churches, all the denominations, because those are our brothers and sisters. But Messianic Judaism is not Christianity. I make the distinction. Hopefully we have good relationships with the mainstream Christian church. But devout and God-fearing righteous men and women in the mainstream Christian church consider us to be another religion. And it's true. Even if you don't think it's true, believe me, the Christian church thinks it's true. We aren't just talking about the day you choose to worship on and whether or not you eat pork. Messianic Judaism stands upon a completely different set of theological assumptions, a different foundation. And I was thinking about my house today. I was out walking the dog on a retractable leash. I was out walking the dog this morning. And it was beautiful. Wasn't it beautiful? It was like 20 degrees. I felt like a new man. And it's like this is, you know, it was like flowers were growing out of the snowbanks. And I was looking at my house. I was walking through my neighborhood looking at my house. It looks pretty normal on the outside. You know, it looks pretty handsome, handsome-looking house, you know. If you go inside, everything's kiddy-wampus. It's like some sort of fun house. You know, the door frames are all twisted up, and there's like a, you know, you stand on one side of the room, and you're tall, and you go over to the other side, and you're short. And so we used to do that game when the kids were smaller, and the kids would, like, put their trucks down on the floor and just let them go. They're just like, you know, because there's serious foundation problems in my house. There's serious foundation, and we've had the contractors out and everything to look at it, and they say, well, you know, your options are to tear it down or live in it. But hey, we got it cheap, so I can't complain. And it's been, you know, Hashem has been, you know, gave it to us. It's been wonderful, and you know, been able to raise a family there for, thank God, 22 years, right? But the point is, we could do all sorts of cosmetics to it, make it beautiful, but you're never gonna solve that foundational problem. When the foundations are out of whack, there's nothing you can do but start over. To practice Messianic Judaism, whether you like it or not, you know, we're starting over and you find yourself outside the camp. But the message for today is that's okay. That's just the way it is. That's called exile. The writer of the book of Hebrews got this so clearly, so beautifully, that he brings the next point, the very next thing he says is, for here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. And I want you to think about the power and the significance of these words in light of the ensuing destruction of Jerusalem, which was hanging over them. As you know, according to my interpretation, the epistle to the Hebrews was written only a few years before the Jewish revolt began in 66 Common Era, 66 AD, about 6 years before the Romans utterly dismantled Jerusalem and left no stone upon another in the temple and slaughtered and carried away its inhabitants and left it as a ruin. The writer of the book of Hebrews doesn't know this. He doesn't know this is going to happen, but the Holy Spirit does. And in the next few years, when he said, we have no lasting city. How true, how true. I mean, what his point was, he was contrasting the material world, this present world, and the temple made with hands, to the heavenly, to the eternal, to the spiritual, to the temple not made with hands. But his words were prophetic. Here we have no lasting city. If you're going to forfeit your faith for the sake of being able to access the temple, enjoy it while it lasts, how long is it going to last? 6 years. 6 years and there'll be no temple. Wow. No lasting city. Not Jerusalem. Not Hudson. Not Judaism. Not Christianity. None of these institutions. We seek the city that is to come. Messianic Jerusalem. New Jerusalem. Which is why we conclude every holiday with the promise. It's not just a saying, it's a promise. Next year in Jerusalem. Our objective is Messianic Jerusalem. New Jerusalem. The Zion of the Messianic era. The kingdom of heaven on earth. Our hope is not in heaven. Our hope is in Messianic Jerusalem. The capital city of the kingdom of heaven. New Jerusalem. When the Jerusalem above descends to earth. And the dwelling place of God is with men in the world to come. According to the writer of the book of Hebrews, this is exactly what started it all. The quest that began the whole thing when Abraham went out from his land, went out in faith, seeking a place, an inheritance, not knowing where he was going, going to a land of promise, a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs of the same promise, looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. A better country, a heavenly one. And therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he has prepared a city for them.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.